tens of millions of people are trapped in modern-day slavery, rock musician Justin Dillon decided he wanted to do something about that.
Anyone who wants to change the world initially is not necessarily very qualified to do so. It's the ones, like Steve Jobs says, the crazy ones that are the ones that actually change the world. If you just start walking towards that, and you might find that you might change the world in some degree.
The musician turned filmmaker and social entrepreneur shares how he's fighting against modern day slavery. Plus,
astronomy is looking at the universe over and over and over again and seeing new events and different events and trying to understand what the cosmos is all about.
What happens when black holes collide? We get a down-to-earth explanation of some of the most violent and energetic processes in the universe. We also look into how many jobs have been lost at public university campuses across the state. WILL's David Mercer joins us. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Justin Dillon is a musician turned filmmaker and social entrepreneur. He's the founder and CEO of Made in a Free World and the platform he also helped develop with the State Department, slaveryfootprint.org. Helps everyday people understand not just the cost, but every consumer's relationship to modern day slavery. It asks a pretty basic question. How many slaves work for you? I got 58. Justin's new book is called A Selfish Plan to Save the World, Finding Big Purpose in Big Problems. It's not just his story and how he came to be in this world, but also his ideas about how he thinks everyone can make a difference. It's just out a couple weeks ago. He was in Chicago last week for the 2017 Social Innovation Summit and the Justice Conference and joined me at our studio at the Middle Newsrooms in downtown Chicago. Hey, Justin, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited about this.
So your life plan was to be a musician, and that happened.
It did.
And can you take me to the moment where you are recording something and you step out from a studio and you see this article about Cambodia and modern slavery?
Yeah, I got to do my dream, which was to play music all around the world and make records and do all that. And about 12 years ago, I was making a record in L.A. And making a record is very broken up. It's not everyone playing all the time. So my part was done, and I went out to the lobby. And there was a New York Times article on the, I can still see it, on the coffee table that said, the new sex trade. And, of course, that sounds like that title was very interesting. I opened it up and read this article, and I'm reading about what a lot of people know about today is modern-day slavery and sex trafficking and even some labor slavery. 12 years ago, 13 years ago, no one really knew about it. So I felt like I was reading something alone in a studio and that everybody should hear about it. And in fact, it should be broadcast everywhere. And it really captured my heart and kind of in a way that nothing else ever had. And I tried to figure out a way to get involved, and I called nonprofits and expressed my interest in being able to help them. And
you did the thing everyone does,
right?
Yeah, which everyone
thinks
I want to help.
Yeah.
Maybe I should give money.
Yeah.
Maybe I should volunteer for something.
Well, I did what a lot of people do for me almost every day now is emailing me and saying, how can I get involved?
Right.
And so that's why I wrote this book.
And so you did get involved in another way. You decided to make a film about this.
I did. What I realized is what was inside of me, my desire to help, was not being satiated by the activities that were being handed
because
to me.
Because you did do that, right? You did do,
yeah, I
how
raised
can
money.
I get involved?
I did raise money. That was what I was asked to do. Like, very small nonprofits were like, just raise some money for us to go do concerts. We did that. It was awesome. Wrote songs. But it was bigger. It was something more in me. I wanted to participate with not just what I could raise or how much I could give, but what I could do. And I'm finding that that's becoming more and more common. People want to apply who they are to the world's problems, not just what they can give. And so I didn't have a map, and so I had to make my own map. And the first step into my map was to look around my surroundings, which was the music community, and try to figure out how to, you know, configure that to be meaningful. And that's what led to creating a rockumentary film. I think it might be the first rockumentary film and maybe the last. A rockumentary documentary about human trafficking called Call and Response.
And so you write about this in the book, that you found a problem, you realized that you had a passion for it, and then you kind of figured out a path for yourself, which for you was creativity, right? Was this whole idea of, that was kind of the idea behind the film, like, you're an artist, I'm going to use art to try to talk about this.
That's it. So it's very natural, right? It's just What's not natural is when you see problems in the world to think that what you're already good at might be helpful. That's not a natural, normal thought, and that's what I'm trying to help.
Yeah, why do you think that? Because I think, and you write about this in the book, why do you think that we tend to think, well, I'm not working for, you know, the International Refugee Committee of the Red Cross,
right.
I'm not a pastor or some other religious leader or someone who's a humanitarian aid worker, so I can't really do anything.
Yeah, well, that was me. I thought the same thing. But what was inside of me still rocked me and still disturbed me and hijacked me. And so I kind of had to get over my own disqualifications that I would put on myself to be able to change the world. What I found is that no one's actually qualified to change the world. No one's authorized to change the world. We're all authorized. We all have the ability. In fact, what I've learned in my research and also just through my own experience is anyone who wants to change the world initially is not necessarily very qualified to do so. It's the ones, like Steve Jobs says, the crazy ones that are the ones that actually change the world. If you just start walking towards that, and you might find that you might change the world in some degree.
So your crazy was that you end up all over the world with different folks. Like, you're in Haiti with Common, you're in India looking, you know, and you're looking particularly, you're trying to find and document examples of child labor, slavery, and of child labor, of slavery, of all of those things. How did you come to as musicians always tell stories, right? Mm-hmm. How did you come to the idea of this film needs to have both music and stories of these kids in particular?
Well, music is certainly stories, but it's also performance is getting an audience to participate. Performance, when an artist performs, they're taking what's inside of them and asking an audience to come with them and physically participate in what's inside of them, taking them to another world. That's essentially, that was what I knew how to do. That was my trade. And so trying to articulate that, and quite frankly, for the last 10 years, I haven't been a musician for 10 years, I've been doing that same thing. It's just found its way into, I've been trying to take what's inside of me and getting people to participate it and own it for themselves, whether it's a song or a movie or a website or enterprise software.
Right. And so you note, actually, and we should, and I wanted to, it's an important place to kind of also begin with our conversation, that definitions of things are really important. Mm. President Obama was defining,
yes.
You're right about a moment you are at the Clinton Global Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama is talking about modern day slavery.
Mm-hmm.
I think, as you said, we are in a different place than we were 12 years
That's
ago,
right?
Yeah. But I think we do, when we think human trafficking, I think we either think sex workers or kids.
Yeah.
So how should we think about human trafficking, and how should we define modern-day slavery?
One of the greatest contributions that President Obama gave to the modern-day slavery movement was giving it permission to call itself slavery. And in his speech at the Clinton Global Initiative in 2012, he was very clear, and I encourage everyone to listen to it. He was very clear that slavery is indeed sex trafficking, child sex trafficking, but it's also a man who gets kidnapped in Cambodia and ends up on a Thai fishing vessel that goes out to fish for the prawns that end up on our salad. It's also young kids in Uzbekistan who the buses come up in the middle of school, takes them off to the fields and makes them work so that we can have shirts on our back. You know, slavery is defined by anyone who's forced to work without pay, under threat of violence, and unable to walk away. And by that definition, which is a pretty strong definition, it's over 40 million people that are facing that today.
And so for those of us who feel very removed from this, I think it does seem like this is, and you write about this, it seems like this is an insurmountable problem. This is too complex a problem. There's too many systems and cultures and other things involved with this for us to think about.
Mm-hmm. Well, as Dr. Cornel West says, I'm a prisoner of hope. And I actually, and I'm also an opportunist. And I actually think that the problems that we're solving today, you know, like transportation, going to Mars, we can solve all kinds of problems pretty well within the realm of possibility. And more than any other time in history, what is, and a lot of folks will say that globalization has exacerbated slavery, and that's true to a certain extent, but it's also our tool to fix it.
And do you think it's also for us a question of not looking at it as us versus them, I mean, how much of this is looking at the connections that we have with people? As we're thinking about how we can help someone, what we can do, how we can get involved. Yeah. Do you think part of it needs to be sort of a reframing of even looking at our relation to the problem?
At a certain level, I think it's important to understand that slavery is a behavior. It's a business. Sometimes I define it as poverty with the bottom dropped out of it. So it's not necessarily the go-to choice to get things done. And I don't think I think sometimes we think of it as a very sophisticated network. I haven't seen it as such. It's fantastically profitable, but it's not as organized as one thinks. And so it's a behavior that, in a lot of cases, poor people take on to exploit other poor people. And so we need to look at it through all lenses, not just a moral lens, but an economic lens as well. And maybe even looking at if there is some ways we might be inadvertently contributing to the problem. That's why we created Slavery Footprint with the State Department. We called it empirical performance art, which was a way to be able to help consumers understand their own participation in this, even though they don't know. And just knowing, getting to the point you said, how many slaves
right,
work
58.
For you? So just knowing, I believe that that is progress. I think some people feel very disarmed and very overwhelmed by that, because when you hear that number, the first thing you want to do is like, how do I get that down?
Right. So, and let's explain how that works for Slavery Footprint. So I went in and I was doing there's sort of this online, it's kind of like a quiz or a game. It's a huge interaction. And I talked to, and I was able to sort of go through my lifestyle, whether it's food or material possessions or the recreational activities that I do. And then you guys have
all branded, not one brand on there.
No.
So we don't get to point at anyone. We just said we're talking to ourselves. Yeah.
And then you attach data and facts and figures. And we look at particularly, and I think obviously technology has gotten a focus. I think there's been a lot of media and understanding about technology and the supply chain there.
Yeah.
What for you, you had a point, I wonder if you could share the story of when you just sort of were like, I'm just going to email Steve Jobs and ask him about what's going on with what's in an iPhone.
This was back in 2008. And everything we've ever done, my team and I, it's always been to help and to democratize participation. So it's one thing to kind of, you know, be an activist and require a bunch of energy and steam to go, you know, tear down a wall. It's another thing to just kind of put a mirror up to society, to ourselves, and go, gosh, how can we know these things, and how can we build some steps to move forward? And one of the ways that we were just curious if consumers were interested in talking to the brands that they like and letting them know their own footprint. And to test that, we asked we wanted to know, and we wanted companies to know, that we're trying to bring data, not division. Like, we wanted the marketplace to fix this. And the typical way, you know, the typical activist move is to have consumers, you know, get
boycotted.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I don't believe I talk about in the book. It doesn't work anymore.
You don't think that works.
It doesn't. We have to use the marketplace and how it works. We have to make the marketplace work better. And sometimes that means we can't choose the cathartic response of hating the one you love, like the things that you use and being upset about it. That's just catharsis. It goes nowhere. So our interest was, how can we create a conversation that happens between consumers and brands? And so I beta tested it on Steve Jobs.
And his response?
Well, we sent an email that said, hey, Steve, do you know about slavery in the iPhone? Is, you know, this challenge with the minerals
out of Colton?
And I didn't expect. I mean, you know, it's Steve Jobs. But 4 hours later, I got an email back that says, I had no idea. I'll look into it, Steve, with a little hashtag at the bottom. Or not hashtag, but slash, sent from my iPhone, which I thought was funny.
So that's your story. That's Justin Dillon, founder and CEO of Made in a Free World, slaveryfootprint.org. How do you kind of connect that to what you write in the book, which is that maybe everyone doesn't change their career? Like, that's kind of your whole point of this book, right? Not everyone's going to be you.
Absolutely not. Please don't. Yeah.
So then what do you want everyone to be instead?
I want everyone to know that there is a story that's written over their lives that's a hero's journey, and that we find out who we are, as Dr. King said, when we give ourselves away to others. And it doesn't have to be changing careers or going to Haiti or taking on some big, huge problem. It could be challenges in your neighborhood. It could just be something that's happening in your community. I feel like the last 10 years of my life, I've been introduced to like a secret back door to meaning. by getting to participate in problems that never directly affect my life. Slavery has never directly interrupted any part of my life. The exercise of taking on other people's problems, what I found is that it produces something that, quite frankly, comfort, acquisition, and attainment can't, and that's purpose. And I think that's something that we're missing a lot of now. And there's a sense of helplessness, and there's a sense of, how do I contribute? How do I help change the world? We're having a national conversation just about every 5 minutes. And I want people to understand that they have everything inside of them that can to change the world. And the book shows them where all those things are already inside of you.
Are you encouraged by what has happened in, I wonder if you find, you said you hope is sort of, you're kind of an optimist.
Mm.
Do you find that the activism, the what we've seen across the country in the past couple of months, do you think that's encouraging? I'm wondering.
I mean, it's early, but I think that people are finding their voice and finding out who they are and finding something bigger to stand up for, no matter what that is, no matter what side of the political spectrum.
Sure.
And I think that's incredibly encouraging, because the first chapter of the book is called Find Your Riot. And that doesn't necessarily mean go riot. It means that every one of us has something inside of us that we want to see changed in the world. For me, it was slavery. For you, it might be something different. For listeners, something different as well. But everyone has something unique that they can contribute to the world and something they might want to see changed. But like me, initially, don't have the steps to get there. I mean, they may not have much to donate or always feel like they're not donating enough, but they have skills and time and networks. And so this book is a way to kind of help leverage all of that to be able to create the change in the world that we all want to see.
Justin's new book is called A Selfish Plan to Change the World, Finding Big Purpose in Big Problems. It's not just his story, but his ideas about how he thinks everyone can make a difference. He was in Chicago last week for the 2017 Social Innovation Summit and the Justice Conference and joined me at our studios at the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. Justin, thanks for being here.
Thanks
really
for having me.
It.
Yeah.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What happens when a pair of black holes 3 billion light years away collide? More than a century ago, Albert Einstein first predicted that such an event would create ripples in the fabric of space and time, known as gravitational waves. It took 100 years before we were finally able to figure out how to observe them, and now a team of researchers from across the world has done it again for only the third time in history. Several of those researchers are from Northwestern University's Astronomy Research Center, and I'm joined on the line now by two of them. Michael Zevin is a PhD candidate in physics and astronomy. Shane Larson is a research associate professor of physics at Northwestern. He's also an astronomer at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. Shane, Michael, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks.
Glad to be here.
Being here.
Thank you.
Shane, let's start with you. Since we're talking about black holes colliding, I feel like the first thing I need to ask, I think I have a very good sci-fi understanding of black holes, but maybe not a very good real understanding of them. Can you explain what exactly black holes are for everyone?
So I think at zeroth order, the idea that we all have about black holes is the right one, which is it's an object whose gravity is so strong that nothing can get away from them if you fall into the black hole, because in order to get away, you would have to travel faster than the speed of light. And the laws of physics as we know them tell us that that's not possible. So they are objects whose gravity is so strong, they're inescapable.
And Michael, when we think about the idea of black hole collisions, they are some of the most violent and energetic processes in the universe. How big are they? How, in terms of power or energy?
As far as big, black holes can actually be quite tiny. You can have black holes much more massive than the sun that are only 100 or so kilometers across, so much smaller than our planet Earth. But the collisions are monumental events. The problem is that these collisions release so much energy But none of that energy is expected to be in the form of light, something that we could see with a traditional telescope. So leaving us blind to these cataclysmic events that are happening out there in the cosmos.
And Michael, is that why it's been so hard for us to scientists to figure out how to actually observe them?
So black holes have been kind of indirectly observed. We can see how they're affecting systems that are going around them. For example, a star, a black hole could be pulling off material from it and heating it up. So we can see that kind of indirect effect of a black hole in the neighborhood. But being able to detect the collisions of two black holes themselves really requires a different form of information than light. And this is where this big discovery came in of gravitational waves, because they don't emit any light, but they still radiate away these ripples in space.
Shane, can you explain that? Because what does it mean to create a ripple? Like, and I think everyone thinks of, you know, people say, oh, ripple in this fabric of space-time. And again, people have maybe a not clear understanding at all of what that is. What does that mean?
So this is the complicated bit about how we think about modern gravity. So Einstein's ideas about gravity, which we call general relativity, and have now been tested for a century and shown to, you know, describe the universe as we see it, he had to really change the way we think about how gravity should be described. You and I, every day we experience gravity by sitting in our chairs and walking on the floors, and we think of it as a force that pulls us straight down to the ground. And in order to develop general relativity, Einstein had to think about it a little differently. He had to invent a completely new way of thinking about it. And what he settled on was this thing today that we describe as the curvature, the warpage, the shape of space and time. And so when we think about gravitational waves, or when we talk about gravitational waves, we're talking about how that curvature, that warpage of space-time, moves from one place in the universe to another. And if you want to reconcile that with the kind of traditional way you think about gravity, as gravity as a force, I think a not correct mathematical way to think about it, but an intuitive way to think about it, is to imagine that you have some object that's making gravity, two black holes going around each other, and if the gravity changes because they're moving with respect to each other, that change has to get from the black holes to you, wherever you're measuring the gravity, say orbiting in your spaceship far away or at LIGO here on Earth. And that change in the gravity moving through the universe is what we're actually trying to measure. But the right way to think about it, the mathematical way we think about it, the way the universe seems to be properly described, is this warpage or this curvature in what we call space-time.
And so, Michael, is it actually observed as a wave, or is it not just a useful analogy for how we should think about it?
So we actually do observe these ripples as waves. And Shane was talking about how anything that has mass or has energy actually curves the space that it's residing in. But once you start to move things, kind of similar if you were to drag your hand through a pond of water, it'll create ripples that kind of propagate away from the system. So when we have accelerating systems, these curvature, these waves kind of ripple away from that system. So what we would detect here on Earth, billions of light years away, are these ripples that were emanating from this system of black holes very far away in the universe.
Yeah, Shane, you mentioned LIGO. That's the detector that's used to observe this. There's two of them, right? And they're really massive. Can you describe what they look like and why do they have to be so big?
Yeah, so LIGO is the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. So this is the premier gravitational observatory in the world. It's the very first one that was finally successfully put together and detected gravitational waves. There are many others that we also partner with that are slowly coming online as time goes on. There are two facilities. There's one in Livingston, Louisiana, northeast of Baton Rouge, and there's one in Hanford, Washington, so just to the west of Tri-Cities in the eastern part of Washington. So the name, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, laser interferometer is the kind of scientific instrument that it is. There are large laser systems where we shine lasers in two directions. They go down these large tunnels that we call the beam tubes. They're 4 kilometers, or about 2.5 miles from the corner out to the end of the arm, and that goes in two directions. So they're shaped like these gigantic 4-kilometer-long L's. And if you go to Google Maps and, you know, type LIGO Hanford or LIGO Livingston, you can see them in the satellite. They're that big. And then the second part, gravitational waves, well, that's what we're trying to detect. And then the O in LIGO, observatory, I always like to tell people is a bit of optimism that we named LIGO in the 1990s before we had ever made a detection, but we always were hoping we'd get to the day we're at today where this is a real kind of astronomy. It's not just an experiment we do once, we write down the answers, you know, hand them in to our middle school science teacher and go off and do something new, right? Astronomy is looking at the universe over and over and over again and seeing new events and different events and trying to understand what the cosmos is all about. So the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory completely encapsulates what the instrument is, what we're looking for, and what our hopes and aspirations for it as scientists really are. But these are the two here in the United States. There's one coming on in Italy, hopefully by the end of the summer. That's called Virgo. The Japanese, our partners in Japan, are building one in a mine that's called Kagra. And in the early 2020s, we're expecting there should be a duplicate of LIGO that will come online in India.
That's Shane Larson. He's an astronomer at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. He also is an associate professor of physics at Northwestern University. Shane and Michael Zevin, my other guest, are part of Northwestern's Astronomy Research Center, Sierra. And Michael, part of your work as a graduate student at Northwestern involves improving these detectors. How do you know when a signal that gets picked up is actually a gravitational wave and not some other kind of background noise or energy?
So that's a great question. And the background noise is actually one of the hardest parts about this experiment. And to get an idea of why, it's important to kind of understand how minuscule the signals that we're actually getting from space are. So we have these laser interferometers, but what they're acting on as are incredibly precise stopwatches, if you will. So what gravitational waves do when they pass through space is they cause distances to stretch and shrink and stretch and shrink. So when we shoot these lasers down these two equal length arms in this L shape, the lasers race down the arms and come back and meet each other. Now, if the arms are the exact same length, then essentially because of the wave-like nature of light, we will get a signal that disappears in our detectors. But if one of the arms gets a little bit stretched when the other one gets a little bit shrunk, maybe from a passing gravitational wave, for example, then we actually start to see some kind of signal, and this is how we can infer that a gravitational wave is passing through our planet. The problem is these changes in distances that we have to be kind of attuned to detect are about 1,000 times smaller than a proton. So we're stretching this 4-kilometer arm 1,000 times the diameter of a proton. So crazy, crazy, crazy tiny distances. That means that each one of these detectors is really kind of prone to lots of different sources of noise that can kind of give us some kind of energy inside of our detectors. So anything from a strong gust of wind blowing to an earthquake across the world to something within the instrument itself can actually cause these little kind of fluctuations in the length of the arm.
So you mean noises? Yeah, so Michael, you mean noises here on Earth. You don't mean noises.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So one of the big problems is disentangling what is really a gravitational wave signal and what's one of these things that we call noise, one of these things that are affecting the detectors themselves. So one of the big ways that we are able to kind of disentangle the two is having two detectors. So a gravitational wave from space doesn't care about the Earth being there. It'll pass right through our planet and hit both of the detectors very close to the same time, whereas the noise that we're getting from the environment, for example, is unlikely to be correlated to be the same between the two detectors. But one of the things that we're actively working on at Northwestern is developing a system where we actually look to volunteers, that we call citizen scientists, to look at a lot of this problematic noise and help us classify and characterize this noise in the detectors with the hopes of being able to eliminate it from the detectors and actually make our detectors more sensitive to the true signals coming from space.
So, Michael, you actually, I know that program you're talking about, that's the program called Gravity Spy. Is that the one that any citizen scientist could get involved with?
Yeah, that's right. All you need is a computer or a tablet or a cell phone. You can log on to gravityspy.org, and you'll see images that you're able to classify as different kind of noise features. So there are types of noise that appear in the detectors over and over and over again, and getting a good kind of comprehensive classification of all these different kinds of noise features is going to be really beneficial for both understanding where they come from and eliminating them from the detectors to make them more sensitive. All you have to do to start classifying is actually go on to gravityspy.org, and then you can see real data for yourself and help out with the search for gravitational waves.
Shane, unfortunately, we just have a couple minutes left, but I wonder, it sounds like this is a really exciting time to be an astronomer because this was built long before, like, you know, we've known about this for quite some time. We've had the instruments built, now we can finally detect them. I wonder what you think is the significance and what we've learned from this most recent wave that was detected.
So the significance, I think, is that this is a completely new and different way of looking at the universe. You know, all of us have kind of grown up looking at pictures and books and magazines and newspaper articles that are of these, you know, amazing places in the cosmos taken with telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope. And all of that information is gathered with light. And this is a completely new and different way of studying all these very interesting astrophysical phenomena. And as astronomers, it's very exciting because it's teaching us about these, you know, phenomena that we're interested in with very complementary and different information than you can learn with telescopes. And so the expectations is that for those of us who have seen the beginnings of gravitational wave astronomy, as well as the students and new scientists coming up behind us who are going to only ever exist as astronomers with gravitational wave data, the things that we're going to know and learn about the universe will be substantially different from what we've learned up to this point. And that's a very exciting way to kind of be involved with science when you're doing it actively every day.
And did we learn anything? Yeah, did we learn anything new from this most recent observation?
Yeah, so, you know, these first three detections by LIGO have been really interesting because they've all been of black holes. And the very first detection and this most recent detection, the black holes have been substantially heavier than the black holes we would normally expect from standard understanding of how stars behave and live their lives and die. They're about twice as heavy as you would expect from talking to your friends who study how stars die when they blow up. And so that's very interesting. There have been a lot of tinkering and theoretical ideas about how and why that's true. And so now as LIGO begins to put more data on the table, especially like this most recent detection we announced where there's, again, a new set of these heavy black holes that we've never observed before, that's really going to help us pin down and understand all of these very interesting ideas we have about where they come from and how many there are in the universe and why they're important. So that's probably the most important thing about these individual discoveries that has us really excited.
One last question. So when a gravitational wave, you detect them or we observe them, does it make any difference to us here on Earth? Like, it's not like we would feel it or anything, would we?
Yeah, so you know, one of the
I know it's kind of a weird question.
Detect is because, you know, as, you know, sensory interfaces with the universe, none of us has built into our five senses a way of detecting these waves that we're talking about. So we didn't even really know they existed till we kind of deduced their existence through this development of modern gravity that Einstein started. And so from that perspective, you know, they're passing through me and you right now, and we don't even know it. But in the end, as with all things in science, you can't know what the important consequences of making these big discoveries are going to be. It's going to change the way we think about the universe. It will change our ideas about stars and where they come from. The technologies that go into LIGO will ultimately filter out into society and be used in strange and unusual ways. You know, all of those things are what the output of science is. But the discovery itself, you know, the most important thing is that it, you know, maintains our curiosity and it keeps us looking and inspires new questions about who we are and where we came from. And that's what's going on right now. In the future, 25 years from now, when you and I have this interview, then we'll know better about, you know, how it helps your golf game or improves your life in your kitchen, right?
Well, that's Shane Larson. He's an astronomer at the Adler Planetarium, a research associate professor of physics at Northwestern University. I want to thank Michael Zevin, who's a PhD candidate in physics and astronomy at Northwestern as well, for explaining this phenomenon to us. Both of them are part of the LIGO scientific collaboration. We're going to tweet out more information about the waves, about Gravity Spy, if you're interested as well. Michael, Shane, thank you. Thanks so much for explaining this for us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Illinois is a few weeks away from entering its third year without a budget. On The 21st, we've learned about the many ways that this impasse has affected our state. Today, we wanted to focus back again on Illinois' public universities. Just a few weeks ago, we got the news that Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago said they'll be laying off 180 people because they're not getting funding from the state. WILL decided to look into just exactly how many jobs have been lost at our public universities. And what WILL found was that over the past 2 years, roughly 2,400 positions have been lost. That's both through layoffs and attrition at a dozen university campuses across the state. WILL reporter David Mercer joins us now. David, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Can you remind us, please, throughout these years of the budget impasse, how public university funding has been affected?
Well, the General Assembly and Governor Rauner provided partial funding in 2016 and then came back with a second round that was targeted at three of the universities that have been hardest hit, Western Illinois, Eastern Illinois, and Chicago State. But for schools that aren't the University of Illinois and don't have the big financial base to work from, or Illinois State University, which is also relatively financially healthy, a big chunk of their budget does come from the state. And if you don't have it, you don't have the money to do things you'd like to do. So you start drawing down your reserves, and eventually, you might run out. Chicago State hit a point financially last year, you probably recall, where the crisis was particularly acute. And there was talk about, okay, so how do we finish this semester and do we open in the fall?
Yeah, and David, I know in a way it becomes this kind of vicious cycle with especially these smaller schools, right? Obviously, you're going to think labor costs are always going to be one of the highest costs for any institution, any employer. But then one of the biggest sources of revenue for these colleges is tuition. But then if you have students worried about whether the school's going to open if they see layoffs, then you worry about enrollment numbers. And we've started to see this, haven't we, across the state, especially at smaller schools, worries about when you're talking about a Chicago State or a Northeastern Illinois University, worries that the school actually will even be around.
So, certainly that perception exists out there. Last year, at the point when prospective students were applying to schools, I know Eastern Illinois talked a good deal about fighting against that perception, the same to a certain degree at SIU, Southern Illinois University. In talking to people at those schools last week, that still exists. I don't think it's quite as acute as it was last year. They've maybe in part by just still being open and still conducting classes, you fight back against that. But, on the one hand, the schools are in the position of having to try and gently pressure the state to provide funding, talk to people like me about, the reason it's important that they get funding and what it means that they don't have funding, but at the same time reassure, students and parents that we will be here, next fall when you get here.
Yeah, it's a difficult line to walk. You mentioned Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. Am I correct? And based on your reporting, they have had the biggest number of jobs lost through layoffs and attrition?
From what I can tell, about 440 people going back to the point where you last had a budget, a state budget in 2015. And 250 of those are through layoffs, the rest through attrition and things like that.
Wow. And so, David, can you give us a sense of 440, what percentage that might represent of their overall faculty and staff population?
At the top of my head, I don't know what the percentage is. I know that they and the other schools make a point of saying that, they're trying to avoid cuts that directly affect the classroom. So most of the people whose jobs are gone are people who, work in the physical plant, people who do maintenance, things like that. Some office workers, some administration, but they try to keep their hands off of the classrooms as much as possible.
So they try to keep their hands off the classrooms, David, but I know you spoke to Eastern's Vice President of Business and Affairs. Obviously, they're still cutting. That's still 440 positions. How are they handling that?
Well, that's Paul McCann, and he said that in some cases people are doing more jobs than they were hired to do, in effect. You know, you have job A, but you take on some duties of job B and C because those people aren't there anymore. And in the process of talking to him, you know, he was talking about that, and then we talked about the people who do things like maintenance and work at the physical plant. You can't, and he readily acknowledged this, you can't take people who work in an office and say, okay, now you're going to run a boiler, because obviously they're not trained to do that. So there are things that don't get done, things that get done more slowly than usual.
What about, let's go across the state to Western Illinois University in Macomb. How have they been faring?
Western has fewer layoffs, you know, just 28 layoffs over that period, but almost 200 other positions that no longer exist. You know, people have retired and they aren't replaced, or they leave for other jobs in other places and they're not replaced. I think they have a similar set of problems. You know, it's maybe not quite as acute as Eastern, but similar.
Right. And I know same thing with the same story with SIU, a Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. You were talking about the idea of like someone who can't operate a boiler. Has that been the case with SIU? Are they also a lot of jobs being cut? Have they been maintenance?
That's what Ray Goldsmith, who's a spokeswoman for the university, said. Maintenance being the, you know, kind of a catch-all term that I'm using. They have, I'm sure, a variety of job titles. But a lot of what's been cut at SIU and what they're living without now sort of falls into that category. And she talked as well about, you know, things that aren't being done or things that are being done more slowly. That's also affected at SIU in part by the fact that some of those workers have had their hours cut back a bit to, I believe it's 7.5 hours a day instead of 8-hour days. That doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, over the course of a week, it adds up, and a month even more. So it affects project work quite a bit, apparently.
So, David, when you were talking to Ray Goldsmith, I wonder also about enrollment. What is, would we say, I was, again, getting back to sort of that loop of enrollment, I don't know if Southern, other schools have had problems with enrollment prior to the budget impasse, and this has perhaps exacerbated the situation?
I think that's right. Both Eastern Illinois and Southern Illinois and others as well. But at SIU, when I was talking to Ray Goldsmith a little bit about the point at which maybe you start looking at the academic programs you offer and seeing what makes sense and what no longer makes sense based on the size of the enrollment and things like that, she said that those are conversations that they'll be having, as she put it shortly, with their campus and about what they do there and where they go from there. She certainly didn't rule out the possibility that, you know, they could be taking a hard look at what they offer.
Yeah, let's actually hear a little bit of what she had to say. This is spokeswoman Ray Goldsmith.
What you're likely to see there behind the scenes is it's going to take longer to get things done. If something's broken, if something needs to be fixed.
That's SIU spokeswoman Ray Goldsmith speaking to WILL's David Mercer, who's talking to me now about the reporting he's done, taking an overall look at public university, more than a dozen campuses across the state. David's reporting shows that because of the budget impasse, or looking at over the past 2 years, we're looking at roughly 2,400 positions been lost, both through layoffs and attrition. David, I guess the hard thing is how much of those. And this is the thing that's always the tough thing to answer. I know as you reported this, how many of those are directly because of the budget impasse and how many are sort of normal job losses because of attrition?
That's hard to say. At least a piece of the jobs that have been lost due to attrition, I think you can safely assume those folks would have been replaced in better economic times as far as the state of Illinois' budget goes. There's, you know, always pressure to try and be more efficient, you know, every time the state budget rolls around. I think universities are just like social service agencies or anybody else. They're strongly encouraged to take a hard look at how they spend their money and see if there are better ways to spend it.
And David, did you find, earlier you sort of alluded to this, did you find that university representatives were willing to talk openly about their campuses and the situation they're in? Certainly, we've seen some university presidents who, and I think University of Illinois' president, Timothy Killeen, has been very clear about talking about how dangerous this budget situation is in terms of how the long-term effect it's having on public education in the state. I wonder if you find that people are as willing to talk about the short-term impact so openly.
In varying degrees, almost all of the universities responded with at least the numbers I was looking for. Some only responded with that. Northeastern Illinois University was very helpful as far as the numbers go, and in providing the explanation that they provided at the time the layoffs you referenced earlier happened. They declined an opportunity to talk on the air about it. Eastern Illinois and Southern Illinois were very willing to talk about it. And that has, I think, kind of been the case throughout all of this, you know, even as two of the schools that are maybe fighting that perception that there's a problem and you might not want to enroll more than most of the others, they're willing to talk about it and be pretty open about what's going on.
There's a few public universities we mentioned. You mentioned ISU and the University of Illinois, and I should mention both you and I are members of, are employed by Illinois Public Media, which is a part of the University of Illinois. The U of I has not had to lay off employees, but you found that there were unfilled jobs, these vacancies. How many did you find?
Several hundred, a couple hundred in the university system. I think they've tried to concentrate most of the or as many of the jobs as possible in the university system that oversees the three campuses. So that's, you're talking about, administration jobs there. And again, it goes back to the thing that all of the universities want to be able to do, which is avoid cuts that are actually inside the classroom if possible.
And so does that mean, though, if there's unfilled jobs, when a person leaves a position, they're just not replacing them?
Right. That doesn't mean necessarily in the case of the University of Illinois that those jobs are gone. It's just that they're not being filled at the moment.
Yeah. Now, one thing, we've been talking so much about public universities. What about community colleges? How have they been affected by all of this?
It's a little harder to get a handle on community colleges, in part because there are a lot more of them and they're scattered all over the state. The Illinois Community College Board is in the process now of surveying its campuses to try and get a better idea of how many jobs have been lost at all of them. And I don't know, and I don't think they know exactly when they'll have results from that, but I think they feel like they need to have a better idea of what's happening there.
WILL's David Mercer, his reporting looking at how many jobs have been lost at our public university campuses. We'll tweet out a link to his story so you can read more details on that. I know lots of people, David, listening throughout the state, especially those employed at all of these universities, are particularly interested in this reporting. Thanks for taking the time to be with us, David. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We like to play music on Fridays and take a look at the music communities around the state. Dry Look is a band from Champaign. They're playing a show tonight at Cowboy Monkey in the downtown Champaign area. They're playing with other local groups, We the Animal and the Indianapolis band Scanlines. The five-piece punk band released their debut EP called Juiceless Glare earlier this year. We wanted to play a song from that album. That song is actually about a scene from 16 Candles, which, of course, the John Hughes movie filmed around Chicago in the early 80s. Here's that song, Sofa City Sweetheart, from The Dry Look. That was The Dry Look. Again, they're playing tonight in Champaign at Cowboy Monkey. Thanks for joining us on the 21st this week. Next week, we're going to continue discussing the latest Illinois news. On Monday, we're going to be speaking with the owner of a Mexican restaurant in Chicago. He's going to tell us about what he and other Mexican restaurant owners are hearing in their local communities in regards to concern over the Trump administration and its increased focus on immigration.
Like, you know, sometimes you hear from customers almost joke, but at the same time, you know, you understand that almost sometimes with all kinds of humor, there's truth under there that underlies it. When they'll joke about it, like, you know, this will be the last time you'll see me. You know, like, come on, you know, don't say that. But it is, I'd say, a sincere worry, you know, where you know, so much rhetoric is being put out there and it feels like, you know, we were taking two steps forward and now we feel like we're taking two steps back.
You can hear more of that conversation on Monday morning by listening to The 21st. That does it for us today. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecilio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting today from the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening.